KKISTRONG, and this is VOA 1, The Hits.
Hello, and welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Ana Mateo. This program is made for English learners, so we speak a bit slower, and we use words and sentences especially written for people learning English. Here are the stories we have for you on today's program. First, the education report. Susan Shand brings us a story about a college professor helping students feel less alone during the pandemic. Then Dan Friedel brings us a story from Germany about bread and beer. John Russell will tell us about a Lego builder in Vietnam. I will return with words and their stories. And we end the program with The Making of a Nation, our ongoing U.S. history program. But first, here is the education report.
At the end of every workday, Deborah Schwinn gets on a Zoom call. As the new president of Palm Beach Atlantic University in Florida, she is talking to her students. Many of them are alone in quarantine because of the coronavirus. Zoom is an internet-based video conferencing service. Schwinn is also a medical doctor. She worries about how coronavirus restrictions might be affecting the students at the small Christian school she leads. As few as one and as many as 15 students have taken part in the series of 20-minute calls. Schwinn checks on their mental and physical health during the meetings. She tries to lift their spirits, and she asks them if the university is meeting their needs. The Zoom calls have given Schwinn the chance to meet students and build rare relationships as a college president. Palm Beach Atlantic has 3,600 students. Schwinn's leadership there began in May. The quarantined students speak to a healthcare worker every day. They attend classes online. They receive food in their rooms. But Schwinn knows that being alone for days or weeks can cause serious mental health problems. Tabitha Maher is studying music at Palm Beach Atlantic. She has been in quarantine 3 times after showing possible signs of COVID-19. She said the physical separation from others was emotionally difficult, but the Zoom calls helped her feel less alone. It was really rewarding to talk to other people who are going through a similar situation, said the 20-year-old Maher, adding, "The president of the university is looking out for you, and she wants to hear your voices, your concerns, and what is going on." Palm Beach Atlantic decided last summer to permit students to return to classrooms. The university has repurposed one building to serve as quarantine housing. Anyone who becomes infected must move into it and stay until they are well. Pablo Castillo is a Palm Beach Atlantic business student from Guatemala. He said students on the Zoom calls decided to take daily walks to a nearby park. They talk and visit there while staying a safe distance from each other. Castillo praised President Schwinn's actions and plans to behave similarly in the future as a business leader. "This is a great example to take a step down and connect with people," Castillo said. I'm Susan Shand.
And now, here is Dan Friedel.
A German beer maker that usually sells a lot of its alcoholic drink had a problem. In the western city of Düsseldorf, many bars and restaurants are at least partly closed because of COVID-19 restrictions. The rules have been in place since November 2020. As a result, not as many people are buying beer. So the beer maker, Fusion Brewery, had 6,000 liters of its product that were about to go bad. Instead of throwing the beer away, the brewery asked some bread bakers for help. Many bakers already use grain left over from the brewing process in their bread. Fusion Brewery's Altbier is now an important ingredient in a special bread called Treberbrot. About 12 bakers in the area are now making loaves of Treberbrot, which means used grain bread. Peter Koenig's family has run the brewery since 1908. It would have been such a shame to just toss out such a tasty beer, he said. The bakers used the beer instead of water in their recipe. Around Düsseldorf, people can buy a loaf of the special bread for less than $5. Each purchase comes with a bottle of beer. Janneke Dirksen's family runs Colvin Bakery. She said, "The brown bread tastes very good with a hard outside and a soft middle. People from other parts of Germany are calling to find out if the bakery can send them loaves of the bread." Dirksen said she would be happy to do that. I'm Dan Friedel.
Thanks, Dan. Next, let's hear from John Russell.
In a room full of Lego pieces, Wang Dong carefully builds a bright blue, yellow, and red fishing boat with a Vietnamese flag. The industrial designer has loved Lego for as long as he can remember. But he only started collecting the objects seriously a few years ago on an overseas study trip to Detroit. He was interested in the many kinds of Lego sets available in the United States. Wang mainly recreates sites close to home in Vietnam. His Lego creations include his childhood home, a temple in Hanoi's Old Quarter, and a 1990s living room during Lunar New Year. All of the designs are complex and have colorful details. Wang used the term perspective, a way of thinking or understanding something, to describe his interest in sharing his love of Lego. "I want to bring my perspective to friends all over the world because Vietnam's Lego building community is still little known regionally and globally," he said. Wang is halfway to his goal of building 10 large models for a public showing. He said it takes about 5 months to finish a 5,000-piece facade or front of a building. But, he added, much of that time is spent finding the right pieces. "I often spend a whole evening to look for just that one brick," he said. Even with a collection of over 2 million Lego bricks, Wang says he is always looking for new pieces. I'm John Russell.
And now, words and their stories from VOA Learning English. Today, we are going to talk about the idea of community. and neighborhoods. Where we live can make a difference in our happiness. Some people love their neighborhoods just the way they are. They do not want them to change. For example, let's say a city council decides that they want to build a big waste treatment plant into a quiet, beautiful neighborhood. A waste treatment plant would be loud. It would bring lots of big trucks through the neighborhood streets. And it would probably smell bad. All these things could lower the quality of living and the property value of the neighborhood's houses. So people in the neighborhood hold protests. They collect signatures to show the city council that the neighbors do not want the waste treatment plant in their neighborhood. They know the plant is necessary, but they want it built somewhere else, not near their homes. And that brings us to our word for today, NIMBY. NIMBY is an acronym. It stands for Not in My Backyard. Usually, the word backyard means the area behind a house. But in this case, it means the whole neighborhood. If you look it up on the internet, NIMBY describes an opposition to putting something considered undesirable in one's own neighborhood. When describing a person, a NIMBY is someone who opposes some form of new development in their community or neighborhood. Their way of thinking is sometimes called NIMBYism. Now, our first example was a waste treatment plant. But many other facilities can bring out a person's inner NIMBY. For example, prisons. They may be necessary, but they are not desirable to some people. Some may think that they could bring unwanted problems to their neighborhood, like crime. But a person may be a NIMBY to other kinds of development too, like big stores or sports stadiums. They may bring business to a city, but they also bring traffic and noise to the neighborhood they're in. For example, let's say a brand new food store is coming to your neighborhood. You are very happy. Finally, you won't have to go far to buy food. But some of your neighbors do not share your happiness. They fear the new store will bring many more people, many more cars, and big trucks to their quiet streets. They may not be able to park their cars easily. So they try to stop the development from happening. Maybe we all have a little NIMBY in us. Maybe we do not know it until our city wants to build a trash processor next to our home. Now let's hear NIMBY used at this neighborhood party.
Hey, did you hear? The city council is voting on the new trash treatment facility tomorrow.
I know, and I will be there with about 50 neighbors to protest.
Oh, are they thinking of building it in your neighborhood?
Yes, and it just doesn't make sense.
Are you sure this isn't just a NIMBY reaction?
Maybe a little, but it really would be cheaper to build it in another part of town.
And what part of town would that be?
Near the railroad tracks. Nobody lives around it. Plus, that location already has an old trash treatment plant. That will save a ton of money.
Those are actually pretty good reasons.
Yeah, I figured if we didn't bring some good reasons to the fight, we would just sound like big NIMBYs.
Now you sound just like little NIMBYs.
I can live with that.
And that's all the time we have for this Words and Their Stories. Until next time, I'm Ana Mateo.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. I'm Steve Ember. We tell the story of the 38th President of the United States.
Mr. Chief Justice, my dear friends, my fellow Americans, the oath that I have taken is the same oath that was taken by George Washington and by every president under the Constitution. But I assume the presidency under extraordinary circumstances never before experienced by Americans.
Gerald Ford was sworn into office on August 9th, 1974. Ford was vice president to Richard Nixon, who had announced the day before that he would resign. If Nixon had not resigned, he might have been removed from office. Congress had been moving to charge him with corruption in the Watergate case. At his swearing-in ceremony, the new president spoke about the nation's future.
My fellow Americans, our long national nightmare is over. Our Constitution works. Our great republic is a government of laws and not of men. Here, the people rule.
He went on to say,
as we bind up the internal wounds of Watergate, more painful and more poisonous than those of foreign wars, let us restore the golden rule to our political process, and let brotherly love purge our hearts of suspicion and of hate.
Gerald Ford became the only leader in American history to have served both as vice president and president without being elected. Richard Nixon chose him as vice president in October 1973. That was when Nixon's former vice president, Spiro Agnew, resigned because of criminal charges that he failed to pay his taxes. When Nixon himself resigned, Ford became president. Ford was a longtime congressman from the state of Michigan. He was well liked by his congressional colleagues. His education was in economics and political science at the University of Michigan. Then he attended Yale Law School. During World War II, he served as a naval officer in the Pacific. After the war, Ford entered politics. He was a member of the Republican Party. He was first elected to the House of Representatives in 1948. He won re-election 12 times. Republicans in the House elected him the minority leader during the administration of Democratic President Lyndon Johnson. Ford was still minority leader when Richard Nixon, a fellow Republican, was elected president in 1968. In his leadership position, Ford helped win approval of a number of Nixon's proposals. He became known for his strong loyalty to the president. It was no surprise then when Nixon named Ford as vice president. Gerald Ford was an accidental president. He came to office in a sudden turn of events. Almost as suddenly, he had to decide what to do about the former president. After Nixon left office, he could have been charged with crimes for his part in covering up the events of Watergate. Instead, 1 month after Nixon resigned, President Ford settled the question. He pardoned Nixon for any crimes that he might have committed. The pardoning of Nixon made many Americans angry. Some believed he should have been put on trial. They thought he might have answered more questions about Watergate if he had not been pardoned. Ford said he pardoned Nixon in an effort to unite the country. For a while, though, the pardon only seemed to intensify the divisions.
And I wondered whether anybody had brought to your attention the fact that the Constitution specifically states that even though somebody is impeached, that person shall nonetheless be liable to punishment according to law.
In October 1974, President Ford appeared before a congressional hearing on the pardon. He gave a strong response to questioning by Democratic Representative Elizabeth Holtzman.
Mrs. Holtzman, I was fully cognizant of the fact that the president, on resignation, was accountable for any criminal charges. But I would like to say that the reason I gave the pardon was not as to Mr. Nixon himself. I repeat, and I repeat with emphasis, the purpose of the pardon was to try and get the United States, the Congress, the President, and the American people focusing on the serious problems we have both at home and abroad. And I was absolutely convinced then, as I am now, that if we had had this series, an indictment, a trial, a conviction, and anything else that transpired after that, that the attention of the President, the Congress, and the American people would have been diverted from the problems that we have to solve. And that was the principal reason for my granting of the pardon.
Anger about the pardon was still strong when President Ford made another controversial decision. He pardoned men who had illegally avoided military service in the Vietnam War. Most of them were not sent to prison. Instead, they were offered a chance to do work for their communities. Many of the men, however, did not accept the president's offer. Some stayed in Canada or other countries where they had fled to avoid the draft. President Ford received greater public support when he asked Congress to limit the activities of the nation's intelligence agencies. He hoped better control would prevent future administrations from abusing the constitutional rights of Americans, as Nixon had done. On another issue, Ford, while serving as vice president, had described inflation as America's public enemy number one. He had supported several measures to fight it. As president, however, an economic recession forced him to cancel some of those measures. Inflation decreased during the recession, but unemployment increased. On foreign policy issues, Ford kept Henry Kissinger as Secretary of State. Kissinger had won much praise for his service to Richard Nixon, including in the opening of diplomatic ties with Communist China. But Kissinger had also received much criticism. Critics accused him of interfering with civil liberties in the name of national security. They also accused him of supporting the overthrow of the Marxist government of Salvador Allende in Chile. By the time Ford became president, the United States and the Soviet Union had taken steps to try to limit the spread of nuclear weapons. Nixon and Soviet leader Leonid Brezhnev had signed two such agreements as part of the détente policy to ease Cold War tensions. Relations with China were also less tense than before. American policy in Southeast Asia, however, had failed. Involvement in the Vietnam War had officially ended the year before Gerald Ford became president. But fighting continued between South Vietnam and communist forces from the North. The peace agreement, signed by the United States and North Vietnam in 1973, left South Vietnam to defend itself. By 1975, South Vietnamese forces were clearly in danger of defeat. President Ford tried to prevent a communist takeover. He asked Congress to approve $700 million in military aid for South Vietnam. Congress said no. The American people were tired of paying for the war. Saigon, the South Vietnamese capital, fell to communist forces on April 30, 1975. President Ford ordered the rescue of American citizens and South Vietnamese who had supported the American efforts. Few people who saw those struggling to escape Saigon will ever forget that day. Terrified Vietnamese were screaming for help at the American embassy. Everyone was pushing, trying to escape the city. Some held on to overloaded military helicopters as the aircraft tried to take off. As a signal to American citizens to prepare to leave, Armed Forces Radio had played the song White Christmas. Some were to go to an apartment building where a helicopter would pick them up from the roof. But other people also tried to get onto the helicopter, a scene captured in a famous news photo of the fall of Saigon. The former South Vietnamese capital was renamed Ho Chi Minh City. In the Middle East, Henry Kissinger led negotiations after the 1973 Arab-Israeli War. Israel agreed to give up some captured territory. In return, the United States promised not to recognize or deal with the Palestine Liberation Organization unless the PLO met certain conditions. In September 1975, Israel and Egypt signed an agreement that included permission for American civilians to act as observers along the ceasefire lines. Henry Kissinger was praised for his peacemaking efforts, though peace in the Middle East would remain a challenge for future administrations. At home, things seemed better as the presidential election campaign of 1976 began. That year marked the nation's 200th birthday. The United States was not fighting any wars. Unemployment remained high, but inflation had eased. Most importantly, Gerald Ford had led the country through the difficult period after Watergate.
And that is our program for today. Thank you for listening. Join us again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Ana Mateo.